8.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice.
His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
Plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
The role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
Now brings you Canceled with Cabal with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
Okay, welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Canceled with Cabal. I'm also on PSN Radio and SoFlo Radio. And I do want to say right off the beginning so I don't forget every time I come back on from a break, all stations are listener supported, so please hit the donate button. Going to continue on reading The Real Anthony Fauci. Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health. Just the book reading today, not going to get into the Out of Babylon series. I'm going to go back about a half a paragraph to revisit from last week. In order to discourage public discussion of those embarrassing abscesses on its sacred cow, the HHS in 1984, the year Anthony Fauci became the director of the NIAID, quietly pushed through an astonishing federal regulation that reflected the agency's institutional culture of paranoia, secrecy, and imperiousness, but not America's democratic values or the U.S. Constitution. Any possible doubts whether or not well-founded about the safety of a vaccine cannot be allowed to exist in view of the need to assure that the vaccines will continue to be used to the maximum extent consistent of the nation's public health objectives. Federal Register, Volume 49, Number 107. Most Americans are shocked to learn that today the abominable regulation is law of our land. No, it's not. Not actually. To complicate these problems, the low-rent polio vaccines Gates uses in Africa and Asia are dramatically different from those used in Western countries. The Bill and Melinda Gates committed more than $1 billion pushing to oral polio vaccine that contains a live polio virus across the global south. This live virus can replicate inside a child's gut and spread in regions with substandard sanitation and plumbing. That means people can contract the virus from the vaccine. Gates' program created windfall profits for pharmaceutical behemoths that could not market such dangerous products in Western countries. Experts argue that Gates' attempts to exterminate polio would be counterproductive. Extirpating the final dwindling dead and infectious requires carpet bombing entire regions with massive vaccination batteries, raising the paradoxical risk of vaccine-strain polio epidemics. I can't see myself how we can satisfactorily eliminate the vaccine-derived strains, said Professor Donald Henderson, a distinguished scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center for Biosecurity. I just don't think it can be done. Henderson is the renowned WHO epidemiologist who led the successful campaign against smallpox during the 1960s. Ignoring such advice, Gates declared war on polio in India and implemented a shock and awe strategy to exterminate those last few cases. Gates took control of India's vaccine oversight panel, the National Advisory Board, by stacking it with loyalists and friendly PIs. Under his control, the NAB mandated an astonishing barrage of 50 polio vaccines, up to 5 for each child, in several key Indian provinces before they reached the age of 5. As Henderson predicted, vaccine-derived polio virus, a mutation of the virus contained in the oral vaccine, came back to bite Gates, and the unfortunate populations of the nations that submitted to his prescriptions. Indian doctors blamed the Gates campaign for a devastating vaccine strain epidemic of acute fluid myelitis, a disease formerly classified as polio, that paralyzed 491,000 children in these provinces between 2000 and 2017, in direct proportion to the number of polio vaccines that Dr. Gates's minions administered in each area. Non-polio acute flaccid paralysis, NPAFP, is clinically indistinguishable from polio, but twice as deadly, according to Keith Van Herren, child neurologist at the Stanford School of Medicine. Van Herren explains that acute flaccid myelitis, AFM, is a polite term for polio. It actually looks just like polio, but that term really freaks out the public health people. Gee, I wonder why. In 2012, the British Medical Journal, Riley noted that polio eradication in India has been achieved by renaming the disease. That year, the disillusioned Indian government dialed back Gates' vaccine regimen and evicted Gates' cronies and PIs from the NAB. Polio paralysis rates dropped precipitously. After squandering half of its total budget on the polio epidemic at Gates' direction, the WHO reluctantly admitted that the global polio explosion is predominantly vaccine-strained, meaning it is happening because of Gates' vaccine program. The most frightening epidemics in Congo, the Philippines, and Afghanistan are all linked to the vaccines he promoted. polio had disappeared altogether from each of those nations until Gates's reintroduced the dreaded disease with his vaccine. In Syria, the Gates-backed Gavi committed $25 million for polio immunization in 2016. The following year, the WHO reported that 58 Syrian children had been paralyzed by the vaccine derived from form of the virus. Other vaccine strain polio outbreaks occurred in China, Egypt, Haiti, and Malaysia. A study of Oxford's Clinical Infectious Disease periodical found that Gates' oral polio vaccine is not only giving kids polio, but also seems to be ineffective in stopping polio transmission. By 2018, the WHO conceded 70% of global polio cases came from Gates' vaccines. As the British Medical Journal reported in 2012, the most recent mass polio vaccination programs in India, fueled by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, resulted in increased cases of polio. In an interview with NPR, Professor of Microbiology Raul Andino said, "It's actually an interesting conundrum. The very tool you're using for polio eradication is causing the problem." Dr. Henderson argued that Gates' futile campaign would strip money from other areas of need, forcing nations to prioritize polio immunization at the expense of other public health investments. Arthur Kaplan, an eminent bioethicist and a polio vaccine fanatic, who himself suffered from polio as a child, also criticized Gates' obsession with polio eradication, pointing out that government budgets and resources in poor nations are diverted from other far more pressing local problems to try and capture the last marginal cases. Donald Henderson observes the only Western nations and billionaires like Gates consider eliminating the disease as a priority. Polio kills far fewer people in developing regions than scourges such as malaria, TB, malnutrition, and the greatest killer, dysentery, from deficient water supplies. When Gates first floated his dream of eradicating polio, developing nations feared a diversion of sources towards an area where the money was least warranted. When you're doing polio, you're not doing other things, Henderson says. At least through 2011, and in several countries, Nigeria, India, and Pakistan, they were giving polio vaccines. In 2012, there were only 223 reported cases of polio worldwide. By any measure, polio is not the world's greatest killers. Road accidents, for example, kill about 1.25 million people each year. Measles kills 150,000 children each year. A number of villagers say, "What is polio? We've never seen it. Why are we worried about it?" Rather than provoking reevaluation, Henderson's concern seems to infuriate Gates. "I've got to get my DA," Henderson response down better. Gates mumbled to one of his aides in 2011 after the New York Times editorial board interviewed him doing his transglobal trek soliciting rich and poor governments to ratchet up their commitment to his polio enterprise. "It's beyond me how somebody hasn't killed the great and wonderful Dr. Bill Gates in the last 10 to 15 years. Just amazes me." uh, I don't know if I want to go into it or not, but I'm sure he has killed or maimed some rich family's child or something, and it just surprises me they haven't taken him out. That response suggests that he is aware of the criticism by the man's most knowledgeable but eradicating diseases. Instead of integrating Henderson's critique into his strategy or executing a mid-course correction, Gates treated Henderson's caveats as a marketing challenge and lumbered onward. His imperviousness policies has accepted collateral damage in its self-serving schemes for humanity. Gates' strategic investments have made him immune to criticism by the media and the scientific community. And so, despite these atrocities, the Gates Foundation steers WHO like a rogue destroyer floundering forward full speed ahead from through the mayhem and the carnage of dead and the paralyzed children whose ruined lives bob in their wake. In 2020, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation boasted that the WHO is now providing unprecedented levels of technical assistance for polio vaccination campaigns in Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. HPV vaccine. In 2009 and 2012, the Gates Foundation funded tests of experimental HPV vaccines developed by Gates' partner, GlaxoSmithKline and Merck, on 23,000 girls, 11 to 14 years old, in remote provinces of India. These experiences were part of the Gates effort to bolster these companies' sketchy claims that HPV vaccines protect women against cervical cancer that might develop in old age. Gates and his foundation have large investments in both countries. Since deaths of cervical cancer occur on an average age of 58 in the United States, and affect only 1 in 40,000 women, and since virtually all these deaths are preventable with early detection by pap smears, any vaccine given to young girls to prevent the low risk of preventable death half a century from now ought to be 100% safe, and this vaccine isn't even close. Both Merck and Glaxo disclosed in their shareholders' reports that profitable performances by their flagship HPV vaccines were top indicators of shareholder value. Gardasil has been a top seller for Merck, earning total global sales of $1.2 billion in 2011, a windfall for the company floundering to recover from a $7 billion court settlement related to criminal charges that the company had knowingly killed between 100,000 to 500,000 Americans by defrauding customers of the safety of its blockbuster pill pain, Vioxx. Merck's executives nicknamed the HPV vaccine Help Pay for Vioxx and fast-tracked it to a market after shoddy safety tests under pressure from Wall Street analysts itching to downgrade Merck's buy recommendations. At least 1,200 of the girls in Gates' study, 1 in 20, suffered severe side effects, including autoimmune and fertility disorders. 7 died, about 10 times the U.S. death. Rates for cervical cancer, which almost never kills the young. India's federal minister of health suspended the trials and appointed an expert parliamentary committee to investigate the scandal. Indian government investigators found that Gates's funded research at PATH committed pervasive ethical violations, pursuing vulnerable village girls into the trial. Pressuring vulnerable village girls into the trial. Bullying illiterate parents and foregoing consent forms. Gates provided health insurance for his PATH staff, but not to any participants in the trials, and refused medical care to the hundreds of injured girls. The PATH researchers targeted girls at ashram, pathshalas, boarding schools for tribal children, to dodge the need to seek parental consent for the shots. They gave the girls HPV immunization cards that were printed in English, which the girls couldn't read. They did not tell the girls that they were part of a clinical trial and instead hoodwinked them with a lie that they were wellness shots that would guarantee lifelong protection against cancer. That was not true. PATH conducted the trials in impoverished rural areas that lacked mechanisms for tracking the adverse effects and had no system for recording major adverse reactions to the vaccines, something legally mandated for large-scale clinical trials. In 2010, the Indian Council for Medical Ethics found that the Gates Group had violated India's ethical protocols. In August 2013, a special parliamentary committee excoriated PATH, stating that the NGO's sole aim has been to promote the commercial interest of HPV vaccine manufacturers, who would have reaped windfall profits had PATH been successful in getting the HPV vaccine included in the universal immunization program of the country. According to Dr. Colin Gonsalves, senior counsel of the Supreme Court of India, the Indian Parliament formed a committee, and it was to be a rather surprising move, because you generally don't often have such a high-level inquiry into matters affecting poor people. And that was such an extraordinary report. I don't think the Indian Parliament has ever come out with such a scathing report. And the government officials come out and said, "We shouldn't have authorized this. We're sorry. And we're not going to allow them again." And now they are back doing the same old tricks. In 2013, two separate groups of health activists and human rights advocates filed public interest litigation petitions calling on Indian Supreme Court to investigate the HPV trials and determine whether PATH and other stakeholders responsible for the trial should be held liable for financial damages in relation to the families of seven deceased girls. One of the lead petitioners, Amir Jassani, a physician who directs the Center for Studies in Ethics and Rights in Mumbai, told Professor McGoy that he regrets that he did not add the Gates Foundation as a defendant. The ethical guidelines of the Indian Council for Medical Research talks about totality of responsibility. It defends the totality of responsibility in terms of everybody. That means sponsor involved, Jassani said. Under that principle, everyone should be held responsible. There is also no evidence that the report that the Gates Foundation took any steps to discipline PATH for the research it carried out in India. I think to some extent the Gates Foundation thinks PATH has done nothing wrong, and that is a concern. No one needs to get a spotlight on the Gates Foundation. The case is now before the country's Supreme Court. The CDC cited Merck's and Gates' cheery assessments of the grotesque Indian experiments to help justify their expanded recommendation for the Gardasil vaccine. Prior to COVID-19, Gardasil was the most dangerous vaccine ever licensed, accounting for some 22% of cumulative injuries. From all adverse events reported to the U.S. Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, VAERS, V-A-E-R-S. During clinical trials, Merck was unable to show that Gardasil was effective against cervical cancer. Instead, the studies showed that the vaccine actually increases cervical cancer by 46.3% in women exposed to HPV prior to vaccination. Perhaps one-third of all women. According to Merck's clinical trial reports, the vaccine was associated with autoimmune diseases in one out of every 39 women. Since introduction of that vaccine in 2006, thousands of girls have reported debilitating autoimmune diseases, and cancer rates have skyrocketed in young women. HPV vaccines and fertility. Gates' strong patronage of HPV vaccines, Gardasil and Cervarix, deepened suspicions that he was weaponizing vaccination against human fertility. Merck's clinical trials showed strong signals for reproductive harm from Gardasil. People in the study suffered reproductive problems, including premature ovarian failure at 10 times background rates. Female fertility has dropped precipitously beginning in 2006 in the United States. Coterminius, I don't know what that word is. Never seen it. Must be another snob word. Coterminius with Gardasil uptake. Historical drops in fecundity, another snob word, have occurred in every nation with high Gardasil uptake. Okay, I'm going to take a break here. If I can find my pen, mark my spot. Some of these words. I don't think a lot of snobs even know these words, Mark. They probably got to look them up too. I don't know. I guess let me see. Find my mouse. Let me see. I think a couple of short songs. I guess be back in about 6 minutes, everyone. So.
Move that mountain, you can move that mountain. Don't wait till hoax and despair. You can find a way. Please believe in what I say. Troubles all will vanish.
Welcome back. After the break there. A couple of pretty good songs. I like them. Hepatitis B. The conspiracy by Gavi and the WHO and UNICEF to force India to mandate hepatitis B vaccines is yet another illustration of how, under Bill Gates' hegemony, vaccine industry profits trump public health. The WHO initially recommended hepatitis B vaccinations only in countries with high incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC, the species of liver cancer that the vaccine promises to abolish. I just had a crazy thought, totally off topic. But there for, I don't know how long it was, at least a year, maybe a year and a half, the Democrats and the mainstream media wanted to know what Trump's tax returns were. Where he made his money. But I wonder if they have any sort of an inkling on asking Joe Biden about his tax returns, where his money come from. I wonder if they would find Ukrainian interests in there. Just a little bit of a thought. I don't know. Since HCC is rare in India, the country did not qualify under WHO's initial criteria, which recommended the vaccine only in nations with significant HCC. WHO's policy meant the vaccine manufacturers would lose a market of 1.3 billion people. Notwithstanding such concerns about the high costs and meager benefits of the vaccine, Gates, through his surrogates at Gavi and PATH and WHO, successfully arm-twisted the Indian government in 2007 and 8 into introducing hepatitis B vaccines. Gavi pushed WHO to change the official policy to a new universal recommendation, meaning that even countries with low disease burdens would be required to vaccinate. Gavi hoped this would reopen the Indian markets, who obligingly changed its recommendation to include universal immunization with hepatitis B vaccine for all countries, even those who were HCC, where HCC was not a problem. The Indian government obediently adopted WHO's recommendation. Yes, it would, Mark. Ukraine and Big Pharma. And bioweapons. WHO obligingly changed its recommendation to include universal immunizations with hepatitis B vaccine for all countries, even those where HCC was not a problem. The Indian government obediently adopted WHO's recommendations. Indian academics and public health officials condemned the government's hepatitis B mandates, citing India's extremely low burden from HCC. The Indian Cancer Registry shows the incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma due to hepatitis B infection is only 5,000 cases a year. Independent scientists and Indian physicians argue against immunization. 25 million babies each year to theoretically prevent 5,000 cases of HCC. Anti-cancer vaccines are poor performers, and there is not even meager proof that a vaccine can prevent any cancers. Dr. Jacob M. Pouliad, M.D., chair of the Department of Pediatrics, St. Stephen Hospital, Delphi, told me that even if the vaccine were 100% effective, the need to administer 15,000 vaccines to infants to prevent a single death from HCC might occur decades later. Intuitively, seems an economic way to spend scarce health resources. In a July 17, 1999 commentary published in the BMJ, I forgot what that is, British Medical Journal, Dr. Pouliad observed that the cheapest Indian hepatitis B vaccine cost 360 rupees, about $5, for three doses. Dr. Pouliad points out that that a third of India's population earn less than 57 rupees per capita per month. The main cause of death in India is diarrhea, respiratory infections, and malnutrition. Pouliad says should immunizations against hepatitis B take priority over the provision of clean drinking water? A study of Gates's forced introduction of hepatitis B vaccines in India showed that the vaccine did not reduce hepatitis B, the frequency of chronic carriers, HBsAg positivity, was similar in the unvaccinated as in the vaccinated. The study further suggested that maternal immunization was protecting newborn babies from infection at the time when they are most vulnerable to develop chronic carrier status, NHCC, and that the vaccine program reduces its natural immunity. Paradoxically, therefore, there is a substantial likelihood that Gates's vaccine is increasing the incidence of HCC in the country. These findings demonstrated the absurd futility of hepatitis B vaccination in India. No matter, says Pouliot, Gates's opinion was the only thing that counted. WHO stood firm, taking the position that all countries must include hepatitis B vaccine in their immunization program, even if the vaccine was unsuccessful. Haemophilus influenza B, HIB. WHO followed its hepatitis B debacle with a much weaker recommendation for vaccination against Haemophilus influenza type B, HIB, who the WHO recommended HIB vaccines only in nations suffering a grave disease burden. In an editorial at the Bulletin of the WHO, Indian doctors questioned the need for HIB vaccine in Asia, where the incidence of invasive HIB disease was extremely low. In 2002, Dr. Thomas Shirane, who is now the WHO coordinator of EPI, wrote that based on the available data, HIB vaccine should not be recommended for routine use in India. To overcome such meddling from India's prying medical community in 2005, Gates funded through the Gavi Institute a four-year, 37 million study of max vaccinations with HIB jabs in Bangladesh, intended to showcase a vaccine's benefits. Gavi's Bangladesh study backfired, showing no advantage from HIB vaccination. In response, a formidable coterie of superstar international health experts, all of them coincidentally from Gates-funded organizations, WHO, the Gavi, UNICEF, and USAID, Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and CDC, issued a deceitful proclamation that fraudulently claimed that the Bangladesh study proved a HIV jab protects children from significant burden of life-threatening pneumonia and meningitis. Prominent Indian doctors responded with outrage commentaries in the British Medical Journal and the Indian Journal of Medical Research, describing the Gates-funded study as a devious artifice. Based on Gates's orchestrated guile, WHO in 2006 took the official position that the HIV vaccine should be included in all routine immunization programs. Once again, the Indian government caved into Gates and mandated HIV vaccines in India. where HIV, invasive disease, was nearly non-existent. Yeah, I wonder how much Dr. Gates greased their pockets, or filled their pockets. In self-congratulatory articles, Gavi boasted triumphantly that its role in rescuing the HIV vaccine project in India, after the Bangladesh study proved the vaccine was worthless, waste of money. Gavi, 2007, Levine. Gavi's article notes that since there was little burden from HIV disease in India, it had been a great challenge to gin up support for WHO's recommendation. Gavi bragged in technocratic argo that it twisted the WHO's arm to revise WHO's HIV vaccine policy from a weak, permissive statement to a firm recommendation calling the universal vaccine introduction to all countries. WHO's vault face dragoned reticent Indian health officials to recommend the useless vaccine. Dr. Pouliel explains that incident highlights the influence Gavi and other vaccine manufacturers, funded organizations like the HIV Initiative, have on the WHO, and it impacts vaccine uptake internationally. Pouliel protests that the Gates Foundation has privatized and monetized international public health policy, transforming WHO recommendations into effective mandates and compelling poor countries to pay annual tribute to foreign pharma overlords. Pouliel told me that India and other Asian nations are now effectively compelled to administer the vaccine to increase HIV uptake targets, irrespective of an individual country's disease burden, notwithstanding of natural immunity attained within the country against the disease, and not talking about account, and not taking into account the rights of sovereign states to decide how they use their limited resources. He adds that the mandate and wisdom of issuing such a directive for a disease that has little potential of becoming a pandemic needs to be questioned. Did you get booted again, Mark? Dr. Pouliel's commentary in the British Medical Journal denounced Gates and Gavi for pushing HIV vaccine in developing countries and for falsifying characterizations of the research data in their press release. The directive has come after a number of failed attempts to convince the scientific community of the need for this vaccine in Asia. Pouliel described the HIV saga as a case study in the visible and invisible pressures brought to bear on governments to deploy expensive new vaccines. Pentavalent vaccine. Despite Gates' victory in winning recommendations for HIV and hepatitis B in Asia, actual uptake rates disappointed the pharma Mikados, defying the WHO and Indian Health Ministry recommendations. Local physicians stonewalled the jab. Most Indians had never heard of either illness, but Pouliel told me Indian doctors were not impressed by the need for either HIV or hepatitis B jabs and seldom recommended them to patients. physician resistance stymied Indian health officials from meeting WHO's uptake metrics for the newly recommended shots. To overcome this problem, pharma introduced a diabolically cunning strategy to euthanize three birds. With one stone. The companies withdrew their flagging HIV and hepatitis B vaccines and reinstated a new concoction that combined these immunizations with the DTP, which, despite its popularity, had become another sandbag in Big Pharma's profit ambitions. By 2008, Pfizer's diphtheria patent was long expired, and there was a 63 manufacturers making the vaccine in 42 countries with large surpluses and very low margins. The Gates cabal solved these profiteering problems by brewing up a new 5 diseases vaccine by mixing the DTP, HIV, and hepatitis B formulas into a single syringe. That was awful nice, Ann. The new combination became the new medicine, the new vaccine. The Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, Gavi, and the WHO christened the novel untested and unlicensed concoction the Pentavalent vaccine, and recommended its use in developing countries to replace the DTP vaccine. Compliant Indian health ministries then phased out the DTP, which had been popular with doctors. If any physician or individual wanted DTP, their only choice was to be the Pentavalent vaccine. On its website, Gavi admitted its underlying reason for this caper was to increase the uptake of the hepatitis B and HIV vaccines, in which countries, by piggybacking on the well-accepted DTP vaccine, it was an ingenious money-making connivance. Competition had driven down the cost of DTP to 15.5 rupees, 15 and a half rupees, about 14 cents U.S. The hepatitis B vaccine retailed for 45 rupees and the HIV for 25. Therefore, the combination cost of all three vaccines as purchased separately was $185. However, the new Pentavalent vaccine made by Gates' friend Cyrus Poonawalla, owner of the Serum Institute of India, costs 550 rupees, a 1,440% increase in profits for every vaccine sold. The Food and Drug Administration has not licensed the combination vaccine for either safety or efficacy, and developed countries do not use it. A Cochrane meta-analysis showed that the combination is less effective than the vaccines given separately. Furthermore, the Pentavalent vaccine is life-threatening to infants. Before its Indian debut, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Vietnam previewed the Pentavalent jab. In each of these countries, unexplained deaths followed immunizations. Bhutan suspended the immunization program in October 2009 after 5 cases of encephalitis occurred following the vaccine. WHO persuaded health officials to resume the program, insisting the viral meningitis... meningoencephalitis caused the deaths. Bhutan obeyed, and 4 infants died. Bhutan no longer uses the pentavalent vaccine. The Director of Public Health, Dr. Ugyen Dofu, observes that there have been no more cases of meningoencephalitis among infants after the vaccine was withdrawn. Sri Lanka unleashed the pentavalent vaccine in January 2009 and then suspended the program 4 months later after 5 babies died. Under pressure from the WHO, Sri Lanka reintroduced the vaccine in 2010. Between 2010 and 2012, there were 14 additional deaths following the vaccine, making the total number of deaths in Sri Lanka 19. Vietnam introduced the pentavalent jab in June 2010 and suspended the jab in May 2013 after 27 infants died. After 27 infant deaths. The experience in Pakistan was similar, including at least 3 reported deaths. India introduced pentavalent vaccine in December 2011. Up to the first quarter of 2013, health officials reported 83 serious adverse events following immunization. 21 babies have died in India following immunizations with the pentavalent vaccine. Okay, we're at another break here. So, I guess about another 5 minutes, a little over 5 minutes, see if I can find my mouse here. Be right back in about 5.5 minutes, everyone.
You could see what I once was if you could go with me back to where I started from. Victories God has won.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. I wanted to say that all the stations are listener-supported. So please help support them. Hang on a second, I gotta check something out here. Okay. Gates and the WHO simply trivialized the deaths as sad coincidences or collateral damage. The vaccine was effectively reduced. The vaccine has effectively reduced the incidence of HIV disease in India. However, there has been a proportionate increase in non-HIV strains of H influenza, including non-stereopable strains, causing invasive disease in the post-HIV vaccine era. As usual, there was no accounting. This is only one of many examples of the Gates Foundation prioritizing the mandate for high-cost vaccines in the national immunization programs that Bill Gates effectively controls. Putting aside questions about net costs and benefits from these effectively controls, putting aside questions about net costs and benefits from these dangerous jabs, McGooey agrees with Pulio that the diversion of sanitation and nutrition money is also deadly. The problem is that by prioritizing the delivery of expensive vaccines, other proven interventions lose out. Real-world evidence, including his investments in pharmaceutical, petroleum, chemical and GMO processed and synthetic food, suggests that Gates' obsession with vaccines does not evidence any genuine commitment to health populations. According to Amy Goodman, Gates owns investments in 69 of the world's worst polluting companies. His single-minded obsession with vaccines seems to serve his impulse to monetize his charity and to achieve monopoly controlled over global public health policy. His strategies and corporate alliances in the food, public health, and education sectors may also reflect messianic conviction that he is ordained to save the world from technology top-down, centralized cookie-cutter solutions to complex human problems, and a godlike willingness to experiment with the lives of lesser humans. Lesser humans. Interesting. And Gates' vaccine cartel has amassed Midas-like riches. Early in 2021, a TV interviewer, Becky Quick, observed that Gates had spent $10 billion on vaccines over the past two decades and asked Gates, "You figured out the return on investment for that, and it kind of stunned me. Can you walk us through the math?" Gates responded, "We see a phenomenal track record. There's been over a 20-to-1 return. So if you just look at the economic benefits, that's a pretty strong number." The interviewer pressed him, "If you had put that money into an S&P 500 and reinvested the dividends, you come up with something like $17 billion. But you think it's $200 billion. Gates continued, hastening to add that helping young children live, get the right nutrition, contribute to their countries, that has a payback that goes beyond any typical financial return. The key to it all," he added, "is having that big portfolio. And the key to much of that portfolio is having Anthony Fauci." Yeah, Nancy. And probably Weinstein, too. Or not Weinstein. What's her name? The other California do-gooder. Okay, trying to find the next section here. Chapter 11. Hyping phony epidemics, crying wolf. Governments do like epidemics, just the same way as they like war. Really, it's a chance to impose their will on us and get us scared so that we huddle together and do what we're told. Dr. Damien Downing, President, British Society of Ecological Medicine, Al Jazeera, 2009. Fear is a market. To instill fear in people also has advantages, not only in terms of drug use. Anxiety-driven people are easier to rule. Well, this is a name here. Gerd Gorkerinzer, Director Emeritus at the Max Planck Institute for Educational Research. Torsten Engelbrecht, Virus Mania, 2021. In 1906, infectious disease caused a third of annual deaths in the United States, and 800 to 1,000 of every 100,000 Americans died of infectious disease. By 1976, fewer than 50 Americans per 100,000 died of infectious diseases. And CDC and NIAID were under extreme pressure to justify their budgets. Hyping pandemics became an institutional strategy in both agencies. Pharmaceutical companies and international health agencies, banking and military contractors, soon found purchase in the ecosystem. And random pandemics discovered their own self-perpetuating rationale. Dr. Fauci's critics chide him for routinely exaggerating and even concocting global disease outbreaks to hype pandemic panic, elevate the biosecurity agenda, boost agency funding, promote profitable vaccines for his pharma partners, and magnify his own power. The historic record supports these charges. 1976 swine flu. As chief of the NIAID's clinical psychological section of the Laboratory of Clinical Investigation, Dr. Fauci was, in 1976, a frontline spectator during the NIH's bogus swine flu pandemic. That year, a soldier at Fort Dix died of a lung ailment following a forced march. Army physicians sent some samples to the CDC, which identified the malady as a swine flu. Dr. Fauci's NIAID boss, Richard Krauss, who Dr. Fauci would shortly replace, labored with a CDC counterpart. David Spencer, to spread terror of the catastrophic pandemic and initiate public demand for a vaccine. The NIAID chief convened in-house strategy sessions with Merck's iconic vaccine developer, Maurice Hillerman, and other immunization industry naboobs, another snob word, N-A-B-O-B-S, naboobs. Congressional investigations subsequently landed the notes from these consultations, in which Dr. Hillerman candidly confesses that the resulting vaccine had nothing to do with science and everything to do with politics. In August 2020, Rolling Stone, Gerald Posner, author of Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America, recounted how Merck and other manufacturers utilized their secret meeting with the regulators to hatch a scheme that would guarantee industry profits while shielding pharma from liability. Yes, snowboard alert. This innovation, now a persistent feature of Big Pharma's business model, turned out to be a cartel carte blanche of negligent and even criminal behavior. Pharma and NIAID told Congress, the White House, the public that the Fort Dix swine flu was the same strain responsible for the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. Really? Interesting. Which they warned had killed 50 million people nationwide. Sorry, worldwide. They were lying. Scientists at Fort Dix, the CDC, and the HHS knew that the H1N1 was an ordinary pig virus, posing no risk for humans. Nevertheless, NIAID conducted a hard sell campaign, warning of 1 million deaths in the U.S. Working with the pharmaceutical companies, NIAID and CDC and Merck persuaded incoming President Gerald Ford to sign a bill appropriating $135 million for vaccine manufacturers to inoculate 140 million Americans against the pestilence. At the behest of federal regulators, Ford appeared on TV urging all Americans to get vaccinated. Ford's obligatory references to the 1918 Spanish flu mass fatalities inspired some 50 million U.S. citizens to hotfoot to their local Health Center for injections of hastily concocted, shoddily tested, zero-liability vaccines that HHS and Merck conspired to push to market. CDC Director David Sensor, set up a swine flu war room to bolster public fear amongst an enthusiast and enthused media. The government launched a full-scale promotion campaign, including terrifying TV commercials depicting remorseful patients who dodged their vaccination and suffered serious illness. A CDC press release claimed that popular TV star Mary Tyler Moore had taken the jab. Moore told 60 Minutes she had avoided the shot due to her concerns about side effects. She said that she and other and her doctor were happy she didn't take it. In the end, the actual number of pandemic swine flu casualties in 1976 was not 1 million, but 1. Dr. Harvey Feinberg, who authored the government's 1978 comprehensive postmortem of NIAID's response, is that fake pandemic, response to that fake pandemic, told the WHO bulletin, in 76 the virus was detected in a single military installation at Fort Dix, New Jersey. In the ensuing weeks and months, not one related swine flu case was reported elsewhere in New Jersey, the USA, or anywhere else in the world. At the same time, political decision makers constantly thought that the scientists were giving them no choice but to go ahead and head with a mass immunization program. NIH's influenza and flu vaccine expert, senior bacteriologist and virologist Dr. John Anthony Morris, informed his HHS bosses that the flu scare was a farce and that NIAID's campaign was a boondoggle to promote a dangerous and ineffective flu vaccine for a greedy industry. Dr. Morris had worked for 36 years at federal public health agencies, beginning in 1940. His office at the time of the 1976 outbreak was a few doors down from a hall from Tony Fauci's. Morris served as the government's chief vaccine officer and led the research on the flu and flu vaccines for the Bureau of Biologics Standards, DBS, at the NIH and later the FDA. Morris enjoyed a distinguished career researching viral respiratory diseases. When Dr. Morris protested the fraud, his direct superior ordered him to stand down, advising Morris not to talk about this. His NIH bosses threatened Dr. Morris with loss of employment and professional ruin if he failed to keep his mouth shut. When vaccine recipients began reporting adverse reactions, including Guillain-Barré syndrome, Dr. Morris disobeyed orders, publicly declaring that there was zero evidence that the Fort Dix swine flu was contagious to humans. He reiterated the vaccine could induce neurological side effects. In response, HHS officials confiscated Dr. Morris's research materials, changed the laboratory locks, moved him to a small room with no telephone, reassigned his laboratory staff, forbade him to see visitors except with permission, and blocked his efforts to publish his findings. Finally, after months of threats and petty harassment, HHS fired Morris for insubordination, citing a long list of drummed-up charges, including failure to return library books on time. Over at CDC, scientist Dr. Michael Hetwick was also warning HHS bigwigs that the flu vaccine could cause widespread brain injuries. In 1976, swine flu vaccine was fraught with problems that HHS discontinued the jab after vaccinating 49 million Americans. According to news accounts, the incidence of flu was 7 times greater among the vaccinated than the unvaccinated. Furthermore, the vaccine caused some 500 cases of degenerative nerve disease, Guillain-Barré syndrome, 32 deaths, more than 400 paralyzations, and as many as 4,000 other injuries. Public health officials pulled the vaccine. President Ford fired David Sensor. American taxpayers ended up paying for the swine flu vaccine coming and going through guaranteed profits for Merck at the front end, and outlays for piles of lawsuits from vaccine injury victims on the other side. The government paid $134 million for the swine flu vaccine program. Injured plaintiffs filed 1,604 lawsuits. By April 1985, the government had paid out $83,233,714 and spent tens of millions of dollars adjudicating and processing those claims. In 1987, Dr. Morris testified before Congress. These figures give some idea of the consequences resulting from a program in which the federal government assumes liability of a product known to produce in an undetermined number of recipients serious damage to health. When I left the FDA in 1976, there was no available technique to measure reliably and consistently neurotoxicity or potency of most vaccines then in use, including DTP vaccines. Today, 1987, 11 years later, the situation remains essentially the same. Dr. Morris's research found that flu vaccines often induced fever in children and in pregnant women and serious harm to the fetus. He worried that there were hidden risks for everyone because the vaccine was literally loaded with extraneous bacteria. According to Dr. Morris, there is a great deal of evidence that to prove that immunization of children does more harm than good. In what serves as a concise epitaph for his crosses, Dr. Morris stated, "There is a close tie between government scientists and manufacturing scientists. My results were hurting the market of flu vaccines." In 1977, Dr. Morris instituted a wrongful dismissal suit. The court overruled all NIH's charges against him. Subsequently, a grievance committee unanimously found that his supervisors had harassed and wrongfully terminated Dr. Morris. A group of former FDA and NIH scientists endorsed Dr. Morris' criticisms of the agency. The New York Times quoted a fellow scientist, B.G. Young, who characterized NIH's reprisals against honest scientists as suppression, harassment, and censorship of individual investigators. I finally came to realize that either had to compromise yourself or leave. Morris and Bernice Eddy are the real heroes in front in that place because they stayed and fought. The others voted with their feet and left. Up until his death in July 2014, Dr. Morris remained an outspoken critic of CDC's annual flu shot program. In 1979, Dr. Morris told the Washington Post, "It's a medical ripoff. I believe the public should have truthful information on the basis of which they can determine whether or not to take the vaccine. I believe that given full information, they won't take the vaccine. Dr. Morris's 2014 New York Times obituary reported this statement. The producers of these influenza vaccines know they are worthless, and they go on selling them anyway. Dr. B.G. Young told the New York Times that NIH's industry-dominated culture at the vaccine division had driven away all the honest regulators, those willing to stand up to the pharma. Dr. Fauci, in contrast, is a rare scientist who lasted 50 years at HHS. He has done so largely by aligning himself with NIH's pharma overlords and carrying industry water. It's another break time here, everyone. Just marking my spot. I think, let's see. I guess about a 5 minute song. Well, about a 6 minute song. Be back in about 6 minutes, everyone.
Oh,
Yes, Bible thumper. Mom, I lived in Wichita for 6 months there because my dad had moved out there in like 1977 or something like that. He worked at Beach Aircraft there in Wichita. And I spent 6 months out there before I came back here, came back home. I lived on the eastern edge of Wichita, and I worked on the western edge. So that's my experience of Kansas. Although driving through Kansas a lot of times when I drove truck out to the west coast, it's long and flat, that's for sure. A few hills every now and then, but mostly a lot of flat land. Yep. A lot like Nebraska, though. Nebraska has a lot more hills. The same weapons that NIH used to silence Dr. Morris enforced isolation, disgrace, prohibiting. I wanted to make sure I was on there. Yep, I'm on. Prohibiting him from publishing papers, presenting at conferences, or talking to the press. Changing his laboratory locks to prevent further research. Were already pieces of an established Soviet-style template for silencing dissent scientists at NIH. The agency first unsheathed these weapons in the 1950s to destroy the career of award-winning virologist Dr. Bernice Eddy. The discoverer of the poliomyelitis virus, who later found a cancer-causing monkey virus in the Salk and Sabin polio vaccines. When her research disclosed problems with vaccine safety, NIH officials banned Dr. Eddy from her lab, changed her office locks, and ordered her to refrain from interviews and speeches. After silencing Eddy, NIH gave the contaminated vaccine to 99 million baby boomers who suffered a tenfold increase in soft tissue cancers, resulting in a public health disaster that dwarfs the harms of polio. Dr. Fauci and the government health regulators later used these same techniques to muzzle a parade of in-house scientists, including Dr. Judy Mikovits, NIH contract researcher Dr. Bart Klassen, and CDC's varicella chickenpox vaccine researcher Dr. Gary Goldman, who dared to tell hard truths about vaccine safety and efficacy. In 1976, a swine flu event was the first time the federal government agreed to serve a pharma's insurer. The episode taught the public an important lesson. Tort immunity incentives, dangerous and effective and ineffective vaccines. Industry was the magisterial class learned an entirely different moral from the tragic episode. In 1986, they made swine flu vaccine template the model for the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which shielded all mandated vaccines from liability. At the dawn of Dr. Fauci's career, he learned that both pandemics and fake pandemics provide an opportunity to expand the bureaucracy's power and to multiply the health, the wealth of its pharma partners. T. 2005 bird flu. In 2005, Dr. Fauci revived NIAID script from the 1976 debacle. This time, the villain was an avian flu, H5N1. Like an agitated chicken little, Dr. Fauci had been warned. The world had been warning the world about the imminent bird flu pandemic since 2001. That year, in a paper, Infectious Diseases, Considerations for the 21st Century, Dr. Fauci balefully forecast a bird-to-human transmission of an influenza scourge that would decimate global populations, beginning with Hong Kong. He predicted unprecedented carnage with his new strain of influenza A virus entering a population that is relatively naive for the microbe in question. In 2004, a Vietnam-based Oxford University Clinical Research Unit director, Jeremy Farrar, who would later rise to both knighthood and to command of the powerful Wellcome Trust, and his Vietnamese colleague, Tran Tien Hien, identified the reemergence of the deadly flu, bird flu, or H5N1, in humans. It was a little girl. She caught it from a pet duck that had died, and she dug up and reburied, Farrar told the Financial Times. In 2007, oops, I missed something there. Lost my spot. The Wellcome Trust heavily funded Oxford's Vietnam project. Drug developer Sir Henry Wellcome established the Wellcome Trust with a donation of his stock in Burroughs Wellcome, the British pharmaceutical behemoth. In 1995, the trust sold its stock to Burroughs Wellcome chief competitor GlaxoSmithKline to facilitate the merger of England's two pharmaceutical giants. Wellcome Trust's $30 billion endowment makes it the world's fourth largest foundation and the globe's most prodigious financier of biomedical research, like the Gates Foundation. Wellcome targets its donations to promote the interest of the pharmaceutical industry. In 2007, British medical journalist John Stone raised the issue of phony pandemics in a letter to British Medical Journal online as a part of the swine flu postmortem. There always remains the issue of whether scares are being promoted because of sober assessment or of risk or because they can constitute another bonanza for the pharmaceutical industry. We need better institutional means to spot the difference. But so far, pandemic flu has been disappointing for the horror merchants. Does anyone recall the moral of the story of the little boy who cried wolf? Well, it is what the industry does all the time. In 2020, Farrar would partner with Bill Gates to fund modelier Neil Ferguson, the epidemiologist who produced the widely exaggerated COVID-19 death forecast that helped ratchet up the COVID-19 fear campaign and rationalize draconian lockdowns. As Schwab mentions, Farrar was at the heart of the earlier fiasco involving avian flu, generated around the delusory fear that the virus would cross the species barrier. Ferguson is the modeling Esperanzio at drumming up phony pandemics. His curriculum vitae include, in 2005, Ferguson predicted up to 150 million people could be killed from the bird flu. In the end, only 282 people died worldwide from the disease between 2003 and 2009. Boy, he was only about 150 million people off of 150 million. In 2001, a published Imperial College projection by Ferguson sparked a mass culling of 11 million sheep and cattle during the 2001 outbreak of foot and mouth disease. In 2002, he projected human deaths at 136,000 in the UK from mad cow disease. The UK government slaughtered millions of cows. The actual number of deaths was 177. In 2009, Ferguson's projected the swine flu would kill 65,000 Brits. Swine flu killed 457 people in the UK. In 2020, Ferguson famously predicted up to 2.2 million COVID-19 deaths in the United States and in 2020 alone. Dr. Fauci and many Western countries used Ferguson's projections to justify lockdowns and other draconian mandates. Farrar played a key role in Dr. Fauci's campaign to cover up evidence of government involvement in a potential lab generation of COVID-19. In 2005, Dr. Fauci crowed that his long-awaited bird flu had finally arrived. Using data from Ferguson, he warned it would kill millions of people worldwide unless he and his pharma partners can deploy a vaccine to derail the approaching Holocaust. Oh, boy. Political and medical establishment cheerleaders mobilized for the now familiar drill boasting pandemic panic. Parroting Dr. Fauci's bird anxieties, government ministries of countries like the United States, Canada, and France, and the World Health Organization bewailed that H5N1 was highly contagious and deadly. The World Health Organization and the World Bank screeched that the plague could cost the world $2 trillion. Anthony Fauci prophesies that H5N1 is the time bomb waiting to go off. Klaus Storr, then coordinator of the influenza program at the World Health Organization, amplified Dr. Fauci's augury, predicting that, another snob word, augury, A-U-G-U-R-Y, predicting that between 2 and 7 million people would die, and that billions would fall ill worldwide. In September 2005, Der Spiegel quoted the United Nations Chief Coordinator, David Nabarro, that the new flu pandemic can kill up to 150 million people. The New Yorker offered overwrought bodements of millions of deaths from one of the greatest dangers facing the United States. Pandemic expert Robert Webster invoked military vernacular that had become de rigueur from loosening public purse strings in the post 9/11 biosecurity era. We have to prepare as if we were going to war, and the public needs to understand that clearly. This virus is playing its role as a natural bioterrorist. Everything is a war for these people. But the war seems to be on us. In response to Dr. Fauci's leathered forecast, the White House unveiled a Christmas list for the Bush family's favorite medicine man, including $7.1 billion to protect Americans from his avian plague. President George W. Bush warned that no country can afford to ignore the threat of avian flu. Dr. Fauci trotted out his reliable old chestnut that the new version of bird flu could be as lethal as the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic that killed 50 to 100 million people. Dr. Fauci had reason to know that this wary boogeyman was a canard. In 2008, he co-authored a study for the Journal of Infectious Disease, confessing that virtually all of the influenza casualties in 1918 did not actually die from flu, but from bacterial pneumonia and bronchial meningitis, which are today easily treated with antibiotics, unavailable in 1918. The Spanish flu that government virologists have invoked to terrorize generations of Americans with vaccine compliance is, after all, a paper tiger. Bush told the U.S. Congress the country needed $1.2 billion in sufficient avian virus vaccine to inoculate 20 million Americans. Additionally, he added $3 billion for Dr. Fauci's new seasonal flu vaccines and $1 billion for the shortage of antiviral medications. Bush also demanded that Congress push the Biodefense and Pandemic Vaccine and Drug Development Act of 2005. Granting liability relief to vaccine manufacturers. The pharmaceutical firms told the White House that they would refuse to manufacture vaccines without an impervious shield from tort liability. The act banned lawsuits against even the most negligent, reckless, and reprehensible behavior by vaccine makers, even for vaccinations administered by force. The immunity provision was a blank check to Big Pharma, greed, and criminal profiteering. The National Vaccine Information Center called the scheme a drug company stockholder's dream and a consumer's worst nightmare. Dr. Fauci arranged for rich vaccine contracts to Sanofi and Chiron to shore up the fragile vaccine enterprise. Once again, Dr. Fauci's pandemic was a no-show. By the time it was all over, the WHO estimated that by May 16, 2006, Dr. Fauci's bird flu had killed only 100 people worldwide. As the investigative journalist and attorney Michael Fomento observed in his post-mortem on Dr. Fauci's bird flu hoax, Dr. Fauci's recurring disease nightmares often don't materialize. Fomento recounted in Forbes magazine, around the world, nations heeded the warnings and spent vast sums developing vaccines and making other preparations. 2009 Hong Kong swine flu. In 2009, Dr. Fauci once again hyped a fraudulent epidemic. This time it was Hong Kong swine flu. That year, in the classic bait and switch, which Dr. Fauci and the Wellcome Trust helped to mastermind, the WHO, by then under control of pharma and its emergent funder, Bill Gates, declared the swine flu pandemic. 3 years earlier, Gates had appointed GlaxoSmithKline's director, Tachi Yamada, to run his foundation's global health program. Yamada also sat on the board of Neil Ferguson's outfit, the Imperial College London, which ran the fraudulent modeling that grievously inflated projected deaths counts from 2009 swine flu outbreak and more recently for COVID-19. Gates is one of the largest funders of the Imperial College London's Modeling Center. Neil Ferguson, the epidemiologist who produced the fraudulent projections, also sat on the Wellcome Trust staff with Jeremy Farrar. There was no sign of a pandemic. In May of that year, the WHO had detected some excess cases of seasonal flu, but the symptoms were mild and death rates were very low. Fewer than 145 people worldwide over 11 weeks since its first appearance. Nevertheless, the agency decided in secret meetings to declare a global pandemic. WHO's declaration activated 18 billion worth of sleeper contracts that WHO and Gates's other organizations had pressured various African and European countries to sign with GlaxoSmithKline and other pharmaceutical companies. The secretive agreements obliged signatory nations, including Germany, Great Britain, Italy, and France, to purchase $18 billion of various experimental, untested, fast-tracked, zero-liability H1N1 flu vaccines, most notably Glaxo's product, Pandemrix, in the event that WHO declared a Class 6 pandemic. Then, just in time to trigger the sleeper contracts, WHO and the sleazy switcheroo changed the definition of Class 6 pandemic, deleting the words and the requirements for mass deaths around the globe. You could now have a pandemic with zero deaths, explained Michael Pimento in Forbes magazine. Interesting. I think my voice is about had enough for the day there, folks. I'm going to stop right here. Mark my spot. And hope to see everyone here tomorrow with me and Roger. So I think just a short song to end. And say thanks for coming out, everyone.